On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Alex DePrima about the man, the myth, the legend, C.H. Spurgeon. So we cover all sorts of topics, like who is Spurgeon, what is his family background, how did he become Baptist, how did he deal with things like depression, how is his preaching style really different than others that came before him, how did the tragedy of Surrey Music Hall shape him, and how did he recover from that, what was his overall workload like, and is that something we should replicate or model as Christians and pastors today? What exactly is the downgrade controversy? What role did the Second London Confession of Faith actually play in the day-to-day ministry of the Metropolitan Tabernacle? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. We're a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And when we talk about serious thinking, we mean that in a couple of ways. So we've tried to describe that as creating or cultivating or encouraging an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think that you can be very serious about your thinking, very serious about your arguments and your ideas and what matters and what's important and why it matters, but also be able to do that with traditional Christian charity and kindness, that we can be happy about what we believe and why we believe it, and we can engage people who think differently or think oddly in general. You know, we talk to all sorts of people on the podcast, people who sometimes have weird views, sometimes have what we would describe as that's our view, but all across the spectrum, and it's a lot of fun. We get to learn and engage and be challenged and pushed in different ways. Today, though, we're excited to reintroduce you all to our friend of ours, Dr. Alex DePrima, talking about Charles Spurgeon. So Alex has been on the podcast a couple of times in the past, and we're excited to have him back because he has a brand new biography on Spurgeon. And we've had the pleasure of talking about Spurgeon, but not quite true biography sense, asking pretty much any question related to who he is and his ministry context and everything. So this should be a lot of fun. So Alex, before I get started, I mean, just remind me who you are briefly, but then I want to know, you know, you've written a lot about Spurgeon. What was it that you said, I need to write a new biography of Spurgeon?
Sure. Guys, thanks for having me on. It's a privilege, always a privilege to be with you. Alex DePrima, pastor of Emmanuel Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, a church that by God's grace we planted a little over 7 years ago, and married to Jenna, three kids, 6, 5, and 3. I had the privilege of studying Charles Spurgeon on the doctoral level, Southeastern Seminary, finished that program some years ago. And then as just a side project, as I'm able, I try to write books, and mostly in the arena of history, and history that is largely aimed at the church, though with some sort of academic research behind it that would serve scholars as well. And so in the past, I've talked about Spurgeon and the Poor on this podcast, book I came out with last year, and then recently published Spurgeon, A Life with Reformation Heritage, just came out this year. And the reason for another biography, I mean, there are lots of biographies on Spurgeon. Actually, he dies in 1892, it's 1834 to 1892. In 1892, after he dies in January of that year, there is a biography of Spurgeon that appears literally every month for 24 months straight. A new biography of Spurgeon. Now, most of those biographies, some of them are helpful. They're mostly written by personal friends, kind of warm reminiscences, you know, kind of thing, light on analysis, but helpful at putting together, you know, biographical information, anecdotes, things like that. And then, you know, you had some high points over the following century. In terms of biographical work, a really good biography that came out in the early 20th century would have been W.Y. Fullerton's biography, and then a little after that, J.C. Carlyle's biography. Those are good. Again, both of them new Spurgeon, but both are out of print now. Probably the best introductory biography was by Arnold Dallimore. Dallimore is best known for his two volumes on George Whitefield, massive volumes that came out with The Banner of Truth, excellent biography. But his book on Spurgeon is shorter, maybe 250 pages, and it's an introductory biography aimed mostly at the church, or given for the church. That's probably the best biography that's out there right now, but it was published in 1984, so 40 years ago. And a lot has happened in that time. I mean, Spurgeon hasn't risen from the dead and done new things, but In the last 40 years, a lot's changed. And what has changed has been, I mean, first of all, the scholarly attention given to Spurgeon has exploded. There have been more dissertations written on Spurgeon in the last 20 years than there have been in the last 120 years. There was the founding of the Spurgeon Center in Kansas City, Missouri, Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, hosting the center there, the Spurgeon Library with 6,000 of his volumes there, and a massive archival center now, all kinds of new documents and details about his life being uncovered. And with that explosion of scholarly interest comes all kinds of books and new research projects and research interests and discoveries. And then alongside all of that, I mean, you guys are about my age, I think, into the 2000s, you have the Young, Restless, and Reform movement, if we want to call it that, or the New Calvinist movement, groups like Together for the Gospel, think tanks like the Gospel Coalition, Nine Marks Ministries, seminaries like Southern Seminary and Southeastern Seminary and Midwestern Seminary and RTS, and these seminaries are growing. And there is a resurgence of popular interest in Calvinism, especially evangelical Calvinism. And Spurgeon sort of emerges as one of the leading lights, I think, of that movement. So there's this renewed popular interest in Spurgeon as well. So I try to write this biography, though it is, I intended it as a popular biography that the average Christian could read, but also that the scholar could benefit from. It takes into view the new scholarship of the last 40 years and just the new sort of evangelical context of interest and reinterpretation of Spurgeon that's been going on now. So that's one of the reasons why I felt the biography was valuable. And it's just true, I think, with some of these figures, you know, Spurgeon's huge. You kind of need a new biography every couple of generations to kind of reintroduce him to a new generation. So that was the thought there with the biography.
Jordan, were you going to introduce your co-host, or are you going to?
Oh, did I? Usually, I don't even think about that. You know,
we are here.
I am. We've got Brandon Askew and Matt Gillespie with us as well. So thanks for calling me out, Brandon. Yeah. I'm so, you know, when we've done podcasts in the past, you would always introduce yourself immediately after. But every time since, if I co-host with anybody else, they don't have the same tenacity that you have to insert yourself there.
Well, so I'm used here, to just going. And Matt is here. All right, back on topic. I'm sorry. So maybe, I guess the most fitting place to start would just be with Spurgeon's childhood. So Alex, just walk us through like his family background. What kind of family was he raised in, and what theological influences did he have in his earliest years?
Yeah, Spurgeon was born in rural Essex. That's a county to the east of London, about 50 miles, I suppose, east of London. Very rural and rustic environment. Grew up in a small village. His parents were nonconformists. They were Congregationalists. I assume some of your audience may know what nonconformity is. I mean, in England, you had the state church. Coming out of the Elizabethan settlement, you would have had the Anglican church, the established church, the Church of England. And all those who could not affirm in good conscience the articles of the Anglican church, which were the 39 articles and the liturgical standards, the Book of Common Prayer, both written by Thomas Cranmer, at least originally, you would have been considered a nonconformist or a dissenter. And those were the Baptists, the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, etc. And Spurgeon was born in a Congregationalist home. His grandfather was a minister in a village called Stanbourne. Spurgeon goes to live with his grandfather for about 5 or 6 years. We, for a long time, didn't quite know the reason why. We assumed it was financial pressure on the family. Spurgeon was one of 8 children. I mean, there were 17 children born to his parents, but only 8 survived infancy. And Spurgeon is sent to live with his grandparents. And we now know through the excellent research of Jeff Chang, who's curator of the Spurgeon Library, professor of history at Midwestern Seminary, that actually Spurgeon's dad fell into tremendous financial trouble. Actually ended up in debtor's prison, we believe, for about 6 weeks. Had to basically go bankrupt. He was a grocer. And so he's trying to rebuild the family's life. In the meantime, Spurgeon goes and lives with his grandparents. He's massively influenced by his grandfather, who was, by all accounts, an exceptional man of integrity, Christian zeal, preached the evangelical gospel, and was a man of a Puritan stripe. Spurgeon, there's the famous story of him happening upon these big folio volumes of the Puritans in his grandfather's library. And literally at the age of like 5 and 6, he's poring over, you know, John Bunyan and Richard Baxter and Joseph Alain. And I don't know if he got to John Owen or not, but at least then. He just certainly got to him later. And so Spurgeon's theological world is shaped in large part by his grandfather's influence, both in terms of his theology and his preaching. He was back in with his parents. His dad actually becomes a lay preacher himself and preaches kind of in churches around the area. He would go to hear his dad preach. His mother was devout, prayed over her son, urged him to flee the wrath to come, would literally put her arms around him and pray that God would deliver him and that Spurgeon would come to believe the gospel. And so just a home that, you know, vibrated with gospel piety, a Puritan theology, big views of God and his glory and his sovereignty and Christ as the Savior with whom every man and even children must deal and to whom they must come. So those are some of the influences operating on him and his childhood setting.
Alex, you mentioned that Spurgeon was raised in a Congregationalist home. So great theology, as you're mentioning. Not a Baptist home, though. How did he come to Baptist convictions? And I think you make a passing comment in the book that he did so even before his conversion. Are there
That's right.
So
Spurgeon, he becomes a Christian when he's 15 years old. That's a really famous kind of story, converted in the context of a very confrontational sermon. The preacher actually kind of singles him out. It's in a primitive Methodist chapel. He had been caught in a snowstorm, headed somewhere else to worship that day, ends up turning into this primitive Methodist chapel. There's hardly anybody there. And this kind of farmer, lay preacher, deacon kind of guy preaches this very confrontational sermon about looking to Christ. And Spurgeon does look to Christ, is converted that day. And but he was theologically minded and theologically oriented before he was actually converted. Reading theological books, he just had never come to Christ to be his Savior. But he still studied divinity and thought about the things of God. And so it was in the context of actually attending a school with Anglican views that he was challenged basically to learn the catechism and things like that, and began to study out the issue of baptism. And as he's studying the issue of baptism, he comes to Baptist convictions. He says there's no evidence for baptism in the Bible. There's no such thing as a sponsor. You can't get baptized vicariously with someone else's faith kind of vouching or standing in for you, like your parents or your grandparents. And he just, with characteristic, you know, youthful, Spurgeonic pluck, he kind of stands up to his teacher and says, no, I'm sorry, I don't think this is in the Bible. I don't think that this kind of baptism is valid. And he sort of embraces Baptist views. The funny story to tell about that is, you know, after he's converted in January of 1850, he wants to be baptized. And his parents, you know, there's this kind of protracted back and forth of letters he's writing to them and they're writing to him about whether or not he should be baptized. And he wants their blessing. He doesn't want to pursue being baptized without their blessing, although he feels compelled as a matter of obedience to be baptized. And finally, you know, his parents kind of give in and they say, okay, you want to do this. You see, this is obedience to Christ. This is what your conscience is calling you to do. You know, it's fine. You can be baptized. And he's baptized, I think, May 3rd of 1850. And his mother says something to him along the lines of, you know, oh, Charles, you know, I'd always prayed that you would become a Christian, but I never thought you would become a Baptist. And then Spurgeon says, well, Mother, you know, the Lord has answered with his usual bounty and done abundantly above all that you could ask or think, you know. So he becomes a Baptist early on and becomes a significant figure in Baptist life then in the mid to late 19th century.
So something I'm a little bit interested, well, I guess I'm interested in several things, but one of the things that I'm interested in from Spurgeon's life is, you know, I've heard a lot about depression that he's experienced. What can you tell me about that? What led to that? How did he effectively battle that? Are there lessons that we can think of today as pastors? Maybe it's not only just pastors thinking about people in their own congregation, but themselves that are small church somewhere, like, because I hear about this all the time. They're isolated and they feel like they're lonely. They don't know who they can talk to and they feel depressed. So what can we learn from that?
Sure. So you're right. Spurgeon did wrestle with what we would today call depression. He would call it depression sometimes melancholy, dejection of spirit. There's a lot of things going on here, and I don't think we completely understand his sort of psychological profile here. You know, I suggest in the book there is evidence to think that there might have been a kind of endemic sort of tendency toward melancholy in Spurgeon that even comes to expression in his childhood. He says at one point, to be alone and to retreat within myself. That was my boyish heaven. That's what I wanted to do. His father talks about how he didn't often play with other boys. He was very nervous around large animals, struggled a little bit with anxiety in certain crowds and settings like that, felt sort of suffocated. So there's things like that that are there from the beginning. But he also was extremely extroverted. So there's a kind of that becomes much clearer as he grows to adulthood. So there's just a vast emotional spectrum in Spurgeon. You know, one of the huge events that most people go to, and I think for good reason, it sort of is a flashpoint for aggravating his what are we going to call it, depression or melancholy, is the Surrey Gardens Music Hall disaster in 1856. By this time, Spurgeon is now in London. He's 21 years old, I think 21 at this time. His ministry is growing. He's reaching to thousands every Sunday. And they decide they can no longer fit people in the chapel that they were in, so they rent the Surrey Gardens Music Hall, which could seat like 10 or 12,000. And the first night, the first service there when he's to preach, there are some, you know, rascals in the audience. They think it was some people playing a prank or something. They start to shout, "Fire, fire, the place is coming down," or whatever. And a panic ensues. And actually one of the galleries actually breaks in. And several people are trampled to death. 7 people die. 28 people are injured. And of course, Spurgeon's critics then take this as fuel to criticize his ministry. And look, if he wasn't so arrogant and renting a venue like this and attracting this furor all around his ministry, oh, this would never have happened. And Spurgeon is plunged into a deep depression. His family said, you know, that he could hardly make sense. Spurgeon says his mind was like molten lava. He couldn't even look at a Bible without weeping. And he never really recovered from that event. He would walk with a psychological limp, I think, after that. And to his dying day, I mean, if he were ever to preach in another venue, he insisted on inspecting it beforehand. He would talk about how it unbeckoned at just random intervals. The horror of that day, legitimate trauma of that day would come back to him, and he would be thrown into all kinds of despair. And, you know, as he goes on in his ministry, there are all kinds of signs of psychological distress. I mean, he would talk about sitting at the foot of the stairs, his wife would find him just weeping, and he couldn't identify a reason why he was weeping. He would speak publicly, even in his sermons, of doubting whether or not he was a child of God, of despairing of life itself, of going to places of despair that no man has ever gone. And a brother named Zach Eswine, Eswine, has compiled a lot of quotes actually along these lines in his book, Spurgeon's Sorrows. It's a short little book, blue book by Christian Focus. So this came to expression in numerous ways. I think what's interesting to me, and I think to lots of people today, is that he is incredibly transparent about his struggles with depression, which is something for a Victorian. It's something for an Englishman, period, but a Victorian in particular. This is the age of doilies and dresses and prim and proper and gentlemen and that kind of, you know, rough-hewn masculinity, and Spurgeon is getting up on Sunday mornings talking about depression, discouragement, despair, melancholy, and trying to throw out, lifelines for people who might be struggling as he is. So I think that contributes to his contemporary relevance almost as much as anything. People have found in Spurgeon a helper, a fellow traveler, and one who I think, this is now speaking as a pastor, one who I think successfully navigated those struggles.
As most of our listeners will know, you know, Spurgeon's known as the Prince of Preachers. And so that's, you know, his preaching ability is probably what he's most known for. I wonder if you just take a few minutes to, you know, what was it about Spurgeon's preaching that made it unique to his time? So in comparison to the style of preaching that was sure, most prevalent in London, but also just in general, why was his preaching so effective? And why do we still go back to his sermons, you know, over 100 years later and think about how amazing they are, and they still are, even just on the printed page?
Yeah. Well, the historian's limited in terms of, you know, resources to answer that question. We don't have recordings of him. Obviously, he died in 1892. We have, you know, hundreds of accounts of people who have heard him preach. So I've read lots of those. And then we have his printed sermons themselves. I think if anyone reads the printed sermons, there's such a heartbeat to them, a pulse, a life to them. It it won't surprise you to know he was regarded as the Prince of Preachers if you just read them. It cuts through even on the printed page. But I would say a few things, Brandon. The preaching of the day, I think preaching had fallen on hard times. I think in London in particular, which was the largest city in the world at the time, the typical preaching you would find, certainly in Anglican churches, but even dissenting churches as well, the preacher was a little more stuffy, pedantic. You know, Spurgeon was very critical of the preaching of his day. He would say it was fit more for the lecture halls than it was for the church and for, you know, soul winning and reaching people with the gospel. Spurgeon was hot-blooded. He was earnest. He was alive. He seemed to spring into the pulpit full-grown, didn't seem to have lots of models. I mean, he did have models, but there was an instinct in him, a giftedness in him that was native. He starts preaching at 16 years old, you know, so he was, in that sense, we could say a natural, if we want to use that language. But he, you know, he engaged his whole personality and even his whole body. And I think there was the word that comes up again and again in accounts of his preaching is earnestness, a sense of urgency, a sense of heartbeat to heartbeat, eyeball to eyeball, blood earnestness. I have the message of life to preach to you. Heaven and hell are on the line. This sea of people before me will be in one place or the other, and where they end up depends on how they respond to this message being preached today. And that came through, I think, in his whole persona and his whole bearing. And that was, I think, one of the things so distinctive about Spurgeon compared to a lot of preaching of the day. So much so that people who preferred that more formal style even accused Spurgeon of being vulgar, of being, you know, erratic and kind of explosive and bombastic, because they weren't accustomed to that kind of preaching. But there were other things, I think, that contribute to that legacy as Prince of Preachers. I note a few in the book. I mean, certainly his earnestness, his Christ-centeredness, the prominence of the person and work of Christ in his preaching is just irrefutable. Christ is the keynote of every sermon. And there's so much of the person of Christ that comes through both in the content, but also, and I think the way he preached, I think he sought to take to himself the bearing of the Lord Jesus and how he preached. And people commented on that. I think another key aspect of his preaching was what could be called his simplicity in preaching. By that, I mean simplicity in the older sense, accessibility, clarity, directness, not simplicity as like foolishness or lightheartedness. In fact, J.C. Ryle, who was a contemporary of Spurgeon, who was the Bishop of Liverpool, he wrote a little treatise called Simplicity of Preaching that I think the Banner of Truth made very popular. It's one of those well-known books now. And he highlights Spurgeon as kind of the foremost example of the kind of simplicity in preaching J.C. Ryle himself is after. Again, which is defined in terms of being direct, clear point, speaking in a way that the common man can understand. But what is remarkable about that, guys, is though he spoke in a way that working class people could grasp, people who weren't educated or even literate could understand, ways in which even children could understand, you read his sermons, they're marked by pretty elevated language. Even Shakespearean, you know, language. This was a man who was well-versed in the Authorized Version, John Bunyan, William Shakespeare, poets of the day like Alfred Lord Tennyson of an earlier century, William Wordsworth. He could quote long passages of Shakespeare from memory. He had a complete work of Dickens. I mean, he somehow managed to speak in a way that both people of high and low birth could appreciate and could enter into. He didn't leave anybody behind. So there is a warm accessibility there. But there also is an elevated way of speaking that sort of dignifies God and speaks in vivid colors about sin and grace and the gospel and the sovereignty of God. And it's quite compelling. And again, I think it'd be something to hear Spurgeon. We'd know a lot more. But even if your listeners would just read a Spurgeon sermon, I think they'd detect some of those threads I just identified. Like, I can see how that cut through in a way that was different in 20th century Victorian evangelicalism, or excuse me, 19th century Victorian evangelicism.
Alex, you mentioned his care to not leave people behind in his preaching, and he is obviously justly known as the Prince of Preachers. In some ways, your last book, Spurgeon and the Poor, was kind of like a forgotten Spurgeon 2.0. He's also you know, very energetic administratively and starting up all of these different charities and other agencies. What So he's known as the Prince of Preachers. Maybe he needs to be known as one who cared deeply about the poor as well. What animated that energy that he put into, whether it was the orphanage or the pastor's college or all these different venues for charity work?
Yeah, just a bit of context to what you're referring to, Matt. And I do open this up in the book, Spurgeon and the Poor. Spurgeon was known as a leading philanthropist of his day. And philanthropist, not in the sense of wealthy people giving money, though he made a lot of money and gave most of it away. A Christian philanthropist in the sense of being engaged in what we would think today is mercy ministry or social ministry, seeking to help the poor, the fatherless, the widow, those kinds of things. By 1884, there were 66 benevolent institutions operating out of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. A major focus on children's ministries. There wasn't a system of public education for most of Spurgeon's life. It wasn't until the 1870s. And it was up to the largesse of the churches, really, voluntary organizations to help these kids, who many of them are just combing the streets, you know, combing through garbage, trying to find something to eat. They're working in factories, sort of long hours, and it would be through the work of Lord Shaftesbury that there is factory reform where these kids, some child labor laws are then introduced and all of that. Things like Dickens' London, there are always, in many of his stories, children that factor prominently, and the plight of children is a very prominent theme in his books. Spurgeon was for those kids. He organized Sunday schools, not just like in his building, but Sunday schools were out there in the community. We would provide Bible teaching for the kids, meals for the kids, evangelism for them. There were what were called ragged schools, where you would provide basic education for the children and like reading, writing, and arithmetic. And then, of course, his orphanage. He rescued 1,500 kids off the streets in his orphanage over the course of, 25 years or so. What was driving that was his belief that proceeding out of faith in the gospel would be good works, works of charity, benevolence, faith, that would do good to others. He thought it was the responsibility of Christians and of churches to be known for doing good, to be like that city on a hill where people would see their good deeds and give glory to their Father who is in heaven. He wanted himself and his people to be a people zealous for good works, Titus 2:14. So he very much believed that doing good to neighbor and loving those in need was the most natural thing for Christians to do. As those who had received the grace of God themselves, they would become gracious in their orientation toward others. They would love the poor and the needy. They would commend the gospel by the kind of care they provided. And in that, Spurgeon, no one saw that as weird back then. That was very much the spirit of Victorian Christianity, evangelical Christianity, on both sides of the Atlantic. I make this case in the book, Spurgeon and the Poor, in the appendix of that book, that was the tradition of Christians throughout the centuries. I understand now why this side of the modernist fundamentalist controversies and this side of the social gospel, Walter Rauschenbusch, liberal theology, which has no place for the cardinal doctrines of the faith, but is a healthy social conscience, I guess we could say, or a kind of love for neighbor that's prominent in those movements. I can understand why this side of all that, history, we are a little more cautious about how to see the church's mission, how to see the relationship between the proclamation of the gospel and good works of mercy ministry. But throughout church history, that's not been especially complex. In the early church, it was Christians who founded the hospitals. It was Christians who were rescuing children from the infanticide walls. It was Christians who were advocating for women's rights in the early centuries of the church's existence. Even as I say some of these things, again, for some people, there are alarm bells going off. Oh, is this guy woke? Is he trying to make a woke Spurgeon? Funnily enough, I just remembered I did an interview with you guys, I think, around all the time of George Floyd and CRT stuff that was pretty thickly anti-woke, I think. But what I mean to say is, because there wasn't this liberal drift and this social gospel where people would go with this stuff, Christians were not as gun-shy about doing good, about giving themselves to evangelical benevolence and philanthropy. So Spurgeon is not, though he is on a large scale, this great philanthropist and this great benevolent man, he wasn't doing something that wasn't common for Christians to do in mid-19th century English evangelicalism.
Let's talk about Spurgeon's doctrine for a moment. So he was openly Calvinistic. He had a great reverence for the Puritans. And I know that he had a reverence for the Second London Baptist Confession, and the New Park Street Chapel, if you could trace its roots back before he got there, to Gill and then to Keach. But what about the Second London? Was there, did it have a place in the day-to-day life of the church there at the Metropolitan Tabernacle? Did he ever take the time to teach through it article by article, or was it just kind of sort of in the background?
So the, it's worth noting, you know, Spurgeon's predecessors at his church, it was the church in Carter Lane at one point, Carter Lane Baptist Church, and then later it was the New Park Street Chapel. And then in 1861, Spurgeon moves the church to a new location, and they have an enlarged building. And that's when it takes on the name of the Metropolitan Tabernacle, which is the name of that church to this day. Benjamin Keach was the pastor of that same church. And then John Gill, and then John Rippon. 150 years of pastoral ministry between those three men. So this kind of eminent Baptist legacy at the church, you know, Spurgeon comes to pastor in London. And Benjamin Keach, of course, was the original signatory of the 1689 Confession, the Second London Confession. And so it was, but it was more prominent then in the 1600s. It sort of sat in the church basement and collected dust, you know, by the time Spurgeon got there. And what he does in an unprecedented move, he republishes the Second London Confession, which had been largely forgotten in British evangelical life. I believe it was 1855, he republishes the Confession. You know, the church's relationship with the Confession is interesting. They weren't like strict subscriptionists. They didn't require that every member subscribe to the Confession of Faith. Spurgeon describes it as a guide. He describes it as a standard. He describes it as something to be upheld, but it didn't function in the church the way a lot of confessional churches today would utilize confessions, where they might require adherence among all their elders to that confession or require the members to affirm that confession of faith. Basically, everyone in the church, it sounds like, appreciated the confession. Spurgeon was very vocally in support of the theology of the confession. He himself would agree to the hilt with that confession, was a Puritan through and through, a particular Baptist, unashamed of that heritage and legacy. To my knowledge, I don't know that he ever taught through it article by article. He commends it all the time. He definitely promoted it in the pastor's college among the students there. He would frequently boast about the Puritan theology that we're trying to teach these young men. But I don't know that he himself, I don't know of a record that he himself ever taught through it systematically.
So something I'd be interested to think about with you is his workload. So it seems like he had a significant workload, the amount of stuff he was doing, you know, from the church to benevolence ministries to the pastor's college, all these things. I would venture to think that most pastors today would probably look at that and think, that's insane. I don't know how he did all that. So I guess number one is his model something that maybe the pastors today should look at and say, you know what, maybe I should step up my game a little bit? Or is it a caution and a warning to say what he did is actually unsustainable and not and shouldn't be replicated?
That's a great question. And I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that. I mean, I'm only 7 years into my own pastorate here. A man of more years and pastoral experience could answer that better. I would say there's something to be commended and something that I would not encourage men to take from Spurgeon. What is to be commended is Spurgeon was an evangelical activist, and I mean that in the best sense. The man was burning calories for Jesus. Christ had saved him. His life belonged to the Lord Jesus. He wanted to serve his master. He wanted to be busy doing good. He wanted to preach the gospel with an abandon. And you know, he famously says, I think in his 30s, you know, someone said, you're going to break down your constitution if you keep preaching as much as you're preaching. He'd preach sometimes 10 to 12 times a week. And he said, I am happy to break down. If I had 50 constitutions, I'd break them all down in service to such a master. He's just worthy of my utmost. And well, who doesn't want to commend something in that kind of zeal? We want to be spent for our Lord. And I think we see what's to be commended. I can go to biblical examples more easily and commend them. You know, the Apostle Paul just gave himself in extraordinary service to Christ. I think there's something about his attitude that is commendable to all Christians. We want to be holy. We want to wholly belong to the Lord, and we want him to have all of our heart, soul, strength, and mind, all of our energy, all of our zeal to serve his cause and his kingdom. Well, in that sense, I think Spurgeon is to be commended, and what a model he is to us in that regard. What I wouldn't necessarily commend, I mean, Spurgeon was what many would call a workaholic. He would often work 16-hour days. That was very normal for him. And I do think speculation, of course, but I think that contributed in a major way to his premature death at 57. He didn't take care of himself, and didn't rest well. Worked, played through pain, basically, and pushed through some yellow lights, and maybe even ran some red lights. And had he slowed down a bit, I think we would have gotten more of Spurgeon. And the reason I say that is because his genes were in his favor for a long life. His grandfather lived to be 88. His father lived to be 91. Spurgeon died at 57. His brother, James Archer, lives to be much older than him. I don't know exactly how old. But, who's to say, but if he lived as long as his father and grandfather, that would get him into the 1920s. He would have lived through the modernist fundamentalist controversies. He likely would have been a kind of champion for evangelical orthodoxy during those times. Probably would have met Martin Lloyd-Jones at some point. Might have even met Winston Churchill. He would have passed through World War I. So I do think it doesn't honor God to break ourselves down irreparable ways and to ignore some of the fatigue and but each man, I think, has to make that judgment for himself. But Spurgeon, there is an argument to be made. He worked himself into an early grave. But one thing I do want to say, even as I say that, though he gave himself so vigorously to his work, he was a spectacular family man. He loved his wife well. He loved his two sons well. You will not find a negative word from either of them about their husband, their dad. He was an hospitable man. That can't be said, as you guys probably know, of many figures in church history. But I think Spurgeon was an exemplary husband and an exemplary father, even while carrying on this massive ministry. Well, can I just give one more encouragement, too, to pastors? I'm concerned about this. Everything's bigger and grander with Spurgeon. I mean, he's just larger than life, right? John Piper said this once. It was kind of a throwaway comment, but it really spoke to me as a pastor. We have the parable of the talents. Some are given 5 talents, some 2, some 1. The principle seems to be just invest all you've got, whatever it is, and don't look at the other guy's talents. Look at your own and invest them and bring 100% return into the kingdom. Some will be given 5 talents, some 1. Well, John Piper just made the comment about his dad, who was a traveling evangelist. And he made the comment, it was in the age of Billy Graham, and Piper said, Billy Graham had his tens of thousands. My dad had his, 300 or 400 at his rallies. And he was commending the faithfulness of his dad. And I thought, isn't that great? Sounds like his dad was no less faithful than Billy Graham. But the scope was different. The gifts were different, probably. Well, none of us are going to be like Spurgeon. But we're called to the spheres we're called to. We're given the gifts that God has given us. I just want to say, especially to pastors listening to this, be faithful with what you've got, brothers. You don't need to be like Spurgeon, but he would say to you, whatever you have, give it all for the Lord. Invest it all in his kingdom and seek to give your utmost for his highest. Seek to bring a 100% return from the talents he's given you into the kingdom. And don't be sad or discouraged if, it's not on the scale or the size of a Charles Spurgeon. So I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah. No, that's really good advice. And just, it kind of leads into what I wanted to discuss next, just trying to get your head and your hands around just the sheer scale of his ministry. The massive number of conversions, the volumes published and all the benevolent institutions and everything. It's easy to get lost in just that massive scale. And I'm curious, in talking to you, someone who has spent, hundreds and hundreds of hours, poring over literature on Spurgeon, do you have a favorite, maybe a lesser known story or a little vignette from his life that kind of brings out Spurgeon, the man, not necessarily just Spurgeon, the preacher or the philanthropist, but the man himself? Do you have a favorite story?
There's one. I think I opened Spurgeon and the Poor with this anecdote. Spurgeon used to love going to his orphanage. He would spend his Christmases there. He'd visit there all the time. This is the kind of guy he was. Sometimes if a meeting is canceled in the afternoon for me as a pastor, what will I do at that time? Well, I get ahead on the sermon, or I could go read, this book of theology, or I might go home early to see my kids. If Spurgeon had a broken appointment, he would go to the orphanage. I get some time with the kids, and meet with a few of them. He has, there's a American temperance activist named John B. Gough, G-O-U-G-H. We only know this story because of his memoirs, John B. Gough's memoirs. But he is visiting Spurgeon. He's heard a lot about his ministry. He admires his preaching. He wanted to take a tour of the orphanage, so he goes there with Spurgeon. Spurgeon's taking him on this tour of the orphanage, and Spurgeon, one of the women there, grabs Spurgeon and says, "Hey, one of the boys is in the infirmary. It looks like he is going to die. We had hoped that he would recover, but he's not going to make it. Would you be willing to visit him?" And Spurgeon says, "Of course." He tells Mr. Gough, "You know, you can come with me if you like, but I need to go see this boy." And of course, Spurgeon never records, as far as we know. Only Gough recorded it. So Gough goes with him and just kind of sits there and observes the whole scene. And it's so affecting. Spurgeon prays with this little boy and just warmly encourages him. And Gough kind of takes notes on the whole thing. And then Gough says, you know, basically Spurgeon prays for him. He brings him some gifts. He tells the nurse, you know, bring this boy like a canary in a cage and try to make him comfortable. And he points him to Christ in the warmest possible way. He tells him, you know, "You may see Christ sooner than I will, but I'll meet you there." And it's just wonderful. So tender. And Gough kind of gives this summary to the whole event. I don't know if I can quote it from memory, but he says something like, "I had seen this man hold a congregation of 6,500 persons in a breathless interest. I had seen him as a man universally, publicly beloved and applauded. But when he was sitting beside the bedside of this dear pauper child who his own beneficence had saved, he was to me a greater and grander man than when swaying the mighty multitude at his will." I think that is a wonderful window into Spurgeon's soul. That was by no means a rare kind of occasion. We have dozens and dozens of anecdotes like that. In the early 1960s, he just decides one day he's going to write a letter to every single child, a personal letter to every single child of every student of the pastor's college. There were about 100, those who had graduated, alumni or current students, about 120 at that time. I don't know how many kids that was, but he wrote hundreds of handwritten letters to children, pointing them to Christ, encouraging them in the faith. That was just who he was. And, you know, so I especially like to share that because he was such an evangelical celebrity, a transatlantic celebrity. He was, I'm looking in my study right now across at a December 10th, 1870 Vanity Fair portrait of Spurgeon was published in the newspapers, celebrities of the day or famous men of the day. But people would be mistaken if they think of Spurgeon as this kind of celebrity preacher, too big for his britches, didn't have time for people, you know, which sadly can characterize some in our own day. Spurgeon wanted to be with the needy. He wanted to be appealing to little boys by their bedside. He wanted to be helping congregants in his church. That's the man he was. I think some of those anecdotes reveal that.
Some of your concluding reflections in the book are along those lines. Spurgeon was very much at home in, you know, by the bedside of this child or in the pulpit or ministering to the poor. It seemed like he was not very much at home in controversy, but he did have to engage in controversy at times. Can you tell us a little bit about, maybe we can focus on the downgrade controversy. Mm-hmm. There's another one in there in his life. Give us some context and maybe draw out some lessons for pastors as they engage in controversy today.
Well, the downgrade controversy is just a massive, I mean, it's complex. It's the final episode of his life, really. It's a very dark chapter in his life. We need, and I know there are lots of maybe doctoral students or future doctoral students who listen to this podcast, we need someone to write just a full-on thesis on the downgrade controversy. Mark Hopkins, in his book, Nonconformity's Romantic Generation, has given the best treatment of downgrade. It's about a 60-page chapter in his book. But we need more work there. And there's great archival material on this that has not been really fully mined at the Spurgeon Center. I mean, the basics of the downgrade controversy are that Spurgeon began to become concerned that there was liberal drift in the Baptist Union, his denomination, and real liberal drift. I mean, people denying the existence and eternality of hell, denying penal substitutionary atonement, the veracity of miracles, the infallibility of the Bible. Some were buying into universalism. he becomes concerned about this as early as the early 1880s, but certainly by the mid 1880s, he's very concerned about it. He begins to make his concerns known privately to Baptist Union leadership. He's basically stonewalled. He begins to raise kind of the public alarm in 1887 with a series of articles that begin to be known as the downgrade articles. He starts talking about a downgrade in doctrine that's taking place. Now, this is the 1880s, so you're beginning to see the headwaters of liberal theology coming from Germany that are kind of beginning to trickle down into the divinity schools in England, in English-speaking countries. He calls it the new divinity. Others are calling it the new divinity. It appears that Spurgeon never really attempted a full-on reform movement in the Baptist Union. He really just mounted a protest and then decides, look, I'm not winning the leadership on this. They're going to tolerate these people in the denomination. I can't stay in, though, in a union, a denomination that is going to tolerate this. So he resigns. And I think he thinks and hopes that he's going to kind of just, you know, back off into independency. And of course, Spurgeon is too big a figure, I think, for that to happen. And since he had raised the alarm publicly and made these accusations publicly, the Baptist Union sort of responds by basically taking a vote of censure against him, not the whole denomination, but the council, the leadership of the group, just under 100 or so folks. And they basically say he's been divisive, he hasn't really substantiated his charges and all of that. It's a very complicated situation, but basically then the battle lines are drawn. There are people who are loyal to Spurgeon, people who are not, some of them in the denomination, some of them not. And they're basically arguing over what's happening with the Baptist Union. And Spurgeon, you know, for a while tries to stay out of it. He keeps being brought back into it. And this is the final few years of his life, really, where he's sort of enmeshed in this controversy. Some view him as, you know, the old man who's grouchy and just, you know, well, we don't have as many Calvinists in the denomination as I would like. And so, you know, and then others think, no, I mean, he's right in what he's seeing. And there is evidence for this. There's no question, even just a generation after the controversy, Spurgeon was vindicated. There absolutely were liberals in the denomination, and the Baptist Union became thoroughly liberal after that. But, you know, you mentioned, Matt, you know, Spurgeon is not at home in controversy. I make that statement in the book. I think Spurgeon should be commended on the whole for how he conducted himself in downgrade. He was making a stand for the truth to his own personal hurt. And I think there were denominational politicians that kind of outfoxed him. That kind of tarnished his legacy a bit at the end of his life. But you know, Spurgeon was, he wasn't the most empathetic critic. Sometimes when he would get locked in with his theological opponents, he could be given to exaggeration and overstatement at times. And so I think there were some inflammatory things he said that were taken as bombastic and abrasive. And so, you know, could sometimes miss nuance of points and all of that. On the whole, though, I think he's right in the downgrade controversy. I think he makes some tactical errors. I think he misses some things. He's not a denominational statesman. He's a gospel preacher, a Bible man. And so people who are working and maneuvering through the denominational ladder and things like that, he doesn't have any patience for that and can't see how some would regard that as a valid way to work through denominational change. It gets so complicated, but that's kind of a bird's eye view of what was going on there.
So knowing that about Spurgeon, having lived through that, let's say he's lives today, because, you know, every era seems like we always have controversies. I'm not going to ask you to speak specifically to any controversy, but just, I mean, there's always questions of liberal drift in any more conservative denomination. If he were to look at, let's say, evangelicalism today, would he say, number one, there is serious liberal drift and we need to deal with it? Would he think that but not publicly work it out? Or how would he approach our current landscape today, do you think?
Well, naturally, that's going to depend on each particular denominational group or associational group. So I think some general things I can say is that, you know, when it came to liberal drift in the Baptist Union, I mean, it was capital L, capital D, liberal drift. It was matters of basic orthodoxy that were being questioned. So you might think of J. Gresham Machen and the battle for his denomination, which they ultimately lost. and he leaves and starts Westminster. He loses Princeton, you know. Well, and it could be what maybe Southern Baptists were debating in the 1970s and 80s. You had professors that were denying the virgin birth, a bodily resurrection. I think if those brothers, if a Tom Nettles, let's say, wanted to appropriate Spurgeon and his approach to the downgrade to those who wanted to see error confuted and confounded in the Southern Baptist Convention in the 1970s and 80s, they would have probably an ally there. I think it'd be safe to say Spurgeon would be on their side. You know, the context today is difficult because when I hear people today talk about liberal drift in certain denominations that are technically doctrinally conservative and certainly doctrinally orthodox, they're often talking about social or political leftward drift. You know, an interesting one would be the female pastors issue. That would be a very interesting one to answer. I mean, Spurgeon was definitely against female pastors. My expectation is that he would probably put that in the category of more serious liberal drift, but I'd be speculating on that one. He certainly would raise the alarm about it. I'm almost certain of that. But that doesn't get to the heart of orthodoxy, you know. So yeah, it's hard to say. I'm not eager to throw him into the fray of other denominations' debates and discussions, you know. But I think it's important to note he was happy to be in fellowship with men who disagreed with him on all kinds of secondary issues. He was happy to be in confederation with Arminians. That didn't bother him. As robust a Calvinist as he was, there were different approaches to worship styles and evangelism and things like that. He tolerated that. But it was when these issues got down to basic matters of orthodoxy, that's when the lion roared. I mean, that's when the giant woke up, you know. And I think that's important to keep in mind when talking about his legacy and how he approached those issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one small question. I mean, think less than 2 minutes on this. When it comes to matters of basic orthodoxy, how is he defining that? Is he going to something like today? I think a lot of people would say, look at the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed. Is that something he's appealing to? Or what is it exactly that where he's taking his bearings from? This is a matter of cardinal orthodoxy and this isn't.
I assume that he's utilizing the creeds, but off the top of my head, I can't remember when I did the research on downgrade if he makes a lot of reference to the creeds. He's certainly appealing for them to have a basic creed that they hold to. But he speaks of like the things the church has historically believed, you know, that all Christians have affirmed since the beginning. You know, he'll use that kind of language. And he is advocating for a basic evangelical charter, a basic evangelical creed that even the Union might affirm. They weren't willing to do that ultimately. So, and it would be, though, Jordan, in answer to your question, the main issues I identify, I think four in particular that were the big issues, they would be Apostles' Creed issues. You know, Nicene Creed issues. Those issues worked out in the early days of the church. I mean, universalism, penal some kind of substitutionary atonement, let's say.
Yeah.
The existence of the coming judgment, heaven and hell, and something like the infallibility of the Bible.
Brandon, Matt, do you have any final closing questions that you want to throw out there?
I do. Brandon, you might as well.
No, if you've got those
okay
lightning round ones you want to throw out, that'd be good.
Oh man, this isn't really a lightning round question, but I mean, Alex, you've now written a biography. What is the value, just thinking more generally, maybe particularly about Spurgeon, but also more generally for the church, what is the value of like Christian biography? How would you commend this to be used for pastors and for members of churches?
Well, I mean, the very simple biblical answer is so much of the Bible itself is Christian biography, believing biography. Hebrews 11, the whole premise of that passage is that the sojourn of saints gone before is there for our encouragement and help us in the fight of faith. And so Hebrews 11 is the starting place, but that chapter really doesn't end until Christ comes again. If we can be encouraged by those saints of old, we can certainly be encouraged by those who have come after Christ and have finished their fight and by God's grace persevered. And so as a pastor, I mean, I'm always going to default to biography. I discipline myself to read systematic theology, but I want to read biography all the time because it helps me, because I have fellow travelers. I have older brothers and sisters. I have those who have gone before, men more faithful than me, men who are pastoring my soul, though they lived 100 or 200 or 500 or 1700 years ago. And I do think, you know, a great piece to read is C.S. Lewis's essay on reading old books. You know, keep the sea breeze of the centuries blowing in your hair. And he makes the point, one of the great things about reading old books is you can see the blind spots of your age better. You can understand the things that are perennially relevant and important, the things that unite humanity across time. And all of a sudden, certain niche problems or niche issues of your age, you can see them for what they are. And I do think the better you know history, it does put you in a better position to anticipate the future, because there is nothing new under the sun. You can see how other people navigated controversy, navigated trial, navigated theology, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So the benefits are endless. But the most basic thing I would say is, if Hebrews 11 serves your soul, it's not the same. You know, my biography of Spurgeon is not in the Bible, obviously, you know, or Ian Murray on Martin Lloyd-Jones or Arnold Dallimore on George Whitefield. But the same principle is sort of being applied. Successful fight of faith in the lives of other brothers and sisters can serve our fight of faith here and now. So that would be the encouragement.
That's good. Alex, I've really appreciated this. I think we could probably talk for another couple hours about Spurgeon-related topics. So maybe we'll have to do that again in the future and fill out the rest of the things that we wanted to discuss. But in the meantime, those of you who are listening, go ahead and grab a copy of the book. Enjoy it and share it with those in your church. It's like he mentioned, it's an accessibly written, so it's not going to be above everybody's head. You can actually get it and get encouragement from it. So I encourage you, get a box of them, 10, 20, 30, whatever the size of your church is, hand them out to people. I know Mark Dever always does that at his church. You know, he just has good books that he just hands out during evening services. I think that's a good practice. So get a book like this, hand out a couple copies to people in your congregation, encourage them to read it. I think it will benefit them. Now, everybody's been listening. Thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Save big money on your next outdoor project at Menards. Menards has the best in-stock selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber. Our huge inventory of decking, fencing, lumber, and timbers are all easy to load in our drive-through lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our fence and deck design programs in-store or online at menards.com. Don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.